While many of us understand the meaning, background, and purpose of the August 10th Memorial Day, there are many who are not aware of how and why the protests sprang forth out of Canadian prisons. For this reason, we have asked prisoner Peter Collins to explain to us how it all began 36 years ago. He begins by describing what the general attitude of prison guards was like, by describing how, after the infamous riots at Kingston Penitentiary, some prisoners were transferred to Millhaven. He begins by describing how they were treated upon their arrival.
After the riots, they shipped over around 40 guys, and when they were bringing them through, they were stripping them naked and beating them as they went through a gauntlet of guards. That wasn't the start of August 10th. It was more just the general attitude of the people working in the prison system toward prisoners, and I guess they were particularly angry with those guys because of the riot that had happened at KP. But the riots and the violence was a sort of a ongoing thing around that time because of the conditions that that people were being held in. And so after they had arrived at Millhaven, prisoners were trying to get better living conditions, better working conditions. Those kind of improvements were not forthcoming by the prison administrators, and so there were strikes and efforts to work together to get better conditions. So one of the ways that the Canadian prison system responded, in those days they were called the Canadian Prison Service, and one of the ways they responded was just to clamp down, more security, more oppression. So people were working toward union striking, and the prison system was working toward breaking those union efforts.
Peter Collins speaks on the history of Prisoners' Justice Day.
Okay, well, around those times, what was going on was some people were refusing to actually participate in the work program that they had in place for prisoners, and so those prisoners were often punished for refusing to work, and one of the ways was they were kept on non-working ranges, and one of the responses that they would do is put people in the hole, and one particular guy, Eddie Nalen, was held in the hole as punishment for refusing to work, and then they would keep on telling him that they were going to let him out to go to a non-working range, and they kept on not letting him out. Eventually they did let him out, but they let him out to a working range where predictably he refused to work, and they locked him back up again. So through an ongoing series of, those kind of spirit-breaking efforts, they had him in the hole, kept on pretending, lying to him that they were going to release him to the non-working range, and eventually he couldn't handle it anymore and decided to kill himself. And so what he did was he slashed himself open, and I guess some of the prisoners heard and were trying to get him medical attention, and the guards just refused to respond to the emergency calls. And it's important to notice that the emergency calls were not just in one unit. You could hear the people screaming and banging on their doors right across that whole prison. That's how loud it was, and the guards just elected to sit in their cubbyhole there, or whatever they call it, and play cards, as was their custom back those days. They just So they just played cards while Eddie died, and then, you know, at some point during their morning walk, you know, which was supposed to be every hour, but that, which they didn't do until the early morning, and then they found him, you know, dead. So that was the start of it. Prisoners then wanted to commemorate his death and protest those conditions and the way he was pushed to suicide, and then when it was happening, the way they refused to respond to it. So the following year, the idea was that no one would accept anything from the man. Right, there was going to be, you know, no acceptance of food, no work, no talking to them, no visits, no, just, you know, just complete silence from the prisoners.
Peter Collins speaks about Bobby Landers.
Bobby Landers was a prisoner being held in Millhaven and, you know, working toward improving conditions still. And, you know, as a result of his efforts there, he was locked in the hole. And while he was in the hole, he had asked to see the nurse and was complaining of chest pains. And they told him, you know, to wait and he could see someone the following day. And when the nurse did come around, she refused to see him, and he died of a heart attack in his cell. He had scribbled a note, you know, explaining what his symptoms were. And at the coroner's inquest, the coroner had indicated that he should have been in an emergency, you know, cardiac unit. And not being held in the hole due to his heart condition, you know, so that sort of solidified the anger and outrage of the prison population, which helped to cement the idea of having a yearly August 10th protests.
Peter Collins is asked about the functioning of the emergency buttons in the segregation cells. The Correctional Service of Canada states that the guards didn't come to aid these prisoners because these buttons were not working. Peter responds,
"Well, that's bullshit, because they just didn't respond to the buttons, you know, they which is their custom today too. You know, they have the ability to shut off the noise that the button makes inside their office, which is what they do, or they just turn them off, you know. So and or they just don't respond to them, and that's what happened, you know. In spite of you know, whatever stories they told to the coroner's inquest, the reality is they just don't respond to those calls if they don't feel like it."
You're listening to the voice of prisoner Peter Collins as he speaks about the history of Prisoners' Justice Day. Peter continues by speaking about Bobby Landers' brother, Glenn Landers, who was killed by the guards the following year.
His brother was being held in Millhaven, and the following year, he had decided he was going to escape the prison, and was shot off the fence trying, and then they refused to go out and pick him up, so he lay there bleeding to death, and they claimed that the reason they couldn't go out and get him was because the prisoners in the shoe yard were outside and refused to go in. But the reason that they refused to go in was they thought something had happened to someone, and that they wanted confirmation that he was being taken care of. The important thing to remember about this particular incident is that the shoe yard is you know, like about a half a mile away from where he was shot off, and there's, you know, multiple security fences in between, and they could, you know, they could just drive in between the fences and pick them up. They just, but instead they just stayed there and let them bleed out.
Peter is asked about the first Prisoner's Justice Day.
Yeah, the first one was in Millhaven, and just again, just you know, complete silence from the prisoners. It was a nonviolent protest commemorating Eddie's death and protesting the conditions. And then, you know, the following year, you know, it built up, and other prisons started to participate in it, and then eventually it spread across the country and into the states, as Australia and, you know, the UK, and so it sort of took on a, you know, global position, I guess, where people are protesting conditions. That's what happened.
Peter is asked what Prisoner's Justice Day means personally to him.
Yeah, well, it's an opportunity to look at things from a wider perspective than your own personal situation, and recognize that there are a lot of people in horrible conditions, and you have an opportunity to acknowledge that and speak for people who no longer can speak, and sort of stand up and be counted as someone who, you know, is concerned about that and wants changes.
Peter Collins speaks on how the Correctional Service of Canada, CSC, has co-opted Prisoners' Justice Day.
One of the problems that's been happening in over the course of August 10th is the prison administrations have tried to shut it down, and they try to shut it down in different ways. You know, like sometimes they would charge people for not going to work, throw people in the hole. That became more difficult for them, and so what they did is became more subversive in their efforts to punish people for participating in the day. And what they've been doing lately is they've been trying to co-opt the day. And what they did last year was they refused at this prison anyway. I don't know about other prisons, you know. So you know, maybe some of your listeners could let me know what's happening at their prison insofar as this particular issue goes. What they did last year was they refused to allow us to print T-shirts with our artwork design on it without signing over the rights to our artwork to CSC, and then they would allow us to print them. So last year I refused to allow them to do, you know, to have the rights of my artwork, because that's an outrageous request on their part. And someone else did give them the rights to their artwork, and so this, the prison, the inmate committee here allowed that to go forward for reasons that are completely beyond me. And this year it would appear that they've done the same thing again. And, you know, it's kind of a shocking, very disgraceful kind of approach to August 10th, when the people who are actually responsible for many of the deaths now are demanding that they own the artwork commemorating these people's deaths. And so, you know, I guess I would encourage people not to allow them to own their artwork, and not to buy shirts that are owned by them. You know, it just seems to be completely wrong on so many levels. And you know, if you can't get shirts made, then just you know, cut a black sock and wear an armband. You know, don't wear a fucking August 10th design that's owned by the prison system.
You've been listening to Prisoner Peter Collins from Bath Prison in Bath, Ontario, explaining the origins of Prisoner's Justice Day.